During the past quarter century, as incomes at the middle and lower levels of the U.S. income distribution lagged, those of the most affluent rose rapidly. Americans have seen this before. The last time income in the United States was concentrated in the hands of such a relatively few people was a brief period in the late 1920s, and, I suspect more durably, in the years preceding World War I. Owing to the rapid development of the United States as a national market in the latter part of the 19th century, income had become highly concentrated by the early years of the 20th century, as the Rockefellers, Fords, Morgans, and Carnegies were able to reach beyond their local fiefdoms to leverage their incomes by many multiples. The newly rich were a much larger group than the prominent few families that so engaged the society pages at the turn of the century. The striking income disparities of the early 20th century, however, were driven by a substantially larger concentration of wealth than exists today. Much of the income concentration of those days reflected interest, dividends, and capital gains from that wealth, rather than wage and salary differentials. Data on wealth distribution in the late 19th century are sparse, but the large prevalence of property income confirms the vast anecdotal evidence of those years. The decline in the concentration of income in the 1930s and through World War II owed to weakened asset values and capital losses, the hyper-tight labor markets of World War II, and the wage and price controls that inhibited supply and demand from functioning. Parenthetically, one consequence of those controls was the emergence of company-supplied medical insurance as a means to attract workers whose wages were frozen. The consequences of that system are all too evident to today's U.S. manufacturers. In contrast, the income concentration of today owes more to the generation of high incomes from work spurred by the imbalance between the demand for skilled workers and their available supply. Nonetheless, the trends are troublesome. Corporate managers persistently identify the lack of skilled workers as one of today's greatest ongoing problems and are willing to bid up pay packages to acquire them. Technological advance is rarely smooth. It can take years for labor markets to adjust to a surge in such demand. They do so by bidding up skilled worker pay scales, which attracts workers from abroad and encourages resident workers to acquire more schooling or otherwise gain greater skills. But the response takes time, and access to skilled foreigners is constrained. In the interim, the rise in skilled worker wage levels, unmatched by a proportionate rise for those with lesser skills, concentrates income in the upper brackets. By and large, aside from many protectionist initiatives, globalization's contribution to increasing inequality has not drawn heavy opposition, at least not yet. The difficulties encountered in the most recent multilateral effort, the Doha round of trade negotiation, to further ease restrictions on international trade, however, have raised political red flags against a further spread of globalization. To a greater or lesser extent, most developed countries have experienced the impact of technology and globalization much as the United States has. Yet, although they confront increasing income concentration, the impact to date appears to be significantly milder than what we are experiencing in the United States. The United States is clearly an outlier among the global trading partners, and that calls for a broader explanation of the causes of U.S. income inequality. Part of the explanation is the more elaborate welfare systems, especially in Europe, that are engaged in far more extensive programs to redistribute income than has been deemed acceptable in the United States. But this is not new. Such disparities existed well before 1980, when income inequality began to become a global problem. A very likely significant part of the explanation for recent developments appears to be the dysfunction of elementary and secondary education in the United States. A study conducted first in 1995 by the Lynch School of Education at Boston College revealed that although our fourth-grade students on an international comparison scale were above average in both math and science, by the time they reached their last year of high school, they had fallen well below the international average. The leading nations included Singapore, Hong Kong, Sweden, and the Netherlands. The study and its follow-ups are available at the International Studies Center's website, http://timss.bc.edu. Follow-up studies in 1999 and 2003 indicated only modest U.S. relative improvement. This education disaster cannot be pinned on the quality of our children. Our students were average or above at age 9 or 10. What do we do to them in the next 7 or 8 years that they test so poorly relative to their peers in other countries? What do we do to their learning process that requires business recruiters to dismiss vast numbers of educated applicants for modestly skilled jobs because they cannot write coherent sentences or add a column of numbers correctly? It is not surprising that, as a consequence, too many of our students languish at too low a level of skill upon graduation, adding to the supply of lesser skilled labor in the face of an apparently declining demand. One can only wonder how our labor markets would behave if our students could match the accomplishments of their counterparts in Singapore. Ironically, many educators in Singapore marvel at the entrepreneurial skills of American youth. These education-driven mismatches of skills, coupled with the forces of globalization and innovation, appear to explain much, if not most, of the failure of real wages at the middle and bottom of our income distribution to rise measurably during the past quarter century. The decline in the ability of labor unions to hold wages above the market has probably had some effect on middle-class incomes, but it cannot be a significant factor in the greater incidence of increased concentration of income in the United States relative to our trading partners, since globalization has weakened the bargaining power of unions worldwide. The key policy levers to address the problem of increasing inequality, as I see it, are thus primarily education and immigration. Markets are already working in that direction. We need to quicken the process. Specifically, we need to harness better the forces of competition that have shaped the development of education in the United States, and we need to make immigration easier for highly skilled individuals. I'll return to these points below. For 3 decades following World War II, in the face of advancing technologies and globalization, we managed to hold the distribution of income stable. How did we do it, and what lessons from that experience will help craft policies that can rein in the growth of income inequality and possibly reverse it? The skill composition of our workforce at the end of World War II meshed reasonably well with the needs of our even then complex capital facilities. As a result, wage-skill differentials were stable, and percentage changes in wage rates were broadly the same for all job grades. The significant addition of college graduates to the labor force, in part the result of schooling financed by the GI Bill, was sufficient to contain wage increases for the highly skilled. Real wages of the lesser skilled also rose, in part as a result of effective high school education and the many skills learned during the war. In short, technical proficiencies across all job levels appeared to rise about in line with the needs of our ever more complex infrastructure, stabilizing the income distribution in the United States for 3 decades. While the GI Bill and on-the-job training in the World War II military were not, of course, initially market-driven, they helped to meet the needs of a changing labor market. By 1980, however, a persistent rise in income inequality began to take hold. Interestingly, despite the marked increase in income concentration over the past quarter century, there is little evidence that the distribution of wealth in the United States has materially changed. High-wage, middle-class factory jobs in the United States have been under pressure from technology and imports since they peaked at nearly 20 million in mid-1979. But in recent years, fear of outsourcing of service trades not previously subject to international competition has added to job insecurity. That insecurity, fostered by global competition, was new for many middle-income Americans, who increasingly became willing to forgo pay raises for job tenure guarantees. Our institutions of education have responded to the skill mismatch that became evident a quarter century ago, but only in part. When I was young, the 1940s, education was seen as preparation for a lifetime of work. Everyone viewed formal education as what you did in your early years. Either you ended your studies after high school, or you went on to college and beyond. Whatever your final degree, educationally, you were set for life. A teenager with a high school diploma would follow his father into the local steel mill, or, if a college graduate, he would seek a job as an assistant to an executive in a large corporation. Steel mill jobs were high-paying, and most people who took them expected to spend the whole of their working lives at the mill. The young male corporate assistants aspired to replace their bosses someday. Young women, by and large, took jobs as secretaries or teachers upon graduation, pending marriage and family. In 1940, only 30% of women between ages 25 and 54 were employed or seeking jobs. Today, the number is more than 75%. But as competition spurred creative destruction, the pace of job turnover quickened and the visions of a lifetime with a single employer faded. It became clear as the 20th century drew to a close that high school or college graduates were likely to hold many different jobs through their working lives and even engage in more than one profession. In response, formal education gradually became a lifetime endeavor, and markets responded. The first evidence of this was the dramatic increase in enrollment in community colleges. After years of being viewed as the backwater of American education, these institutions are now in the vanguard. Student enrollment in two-year colleges rose from 2.1 million in 1969 to 6.5 million in 2004. Almost a third of the students are aged 30 or older. These institutions specialize in teaching practical skills that are immediately applicable in the workplace and have been especially helpful in retraining people who have lost their jobs for new opportunities. Some typical curricula: electronics maintenance, collision repair technology, nursing, massage therapy, and computer information security. These middle-income occupations require substantially more skills than were required of middle-income workers when I entered the labor force in the late 1940s. A rising proportion of the population is also taking advantage of work-related instruction. The corporate university is rapidly becoming a permanent fixture in adult job-specific learning. Many corporations, dissatisfied with the quality of new hires, supplement their education and capabilities, equipping them to compete successfully in world markets. General Motors has an extensive university system with 16 functional colleges. McDonald's educates more than 5,000 employees a year at its aptly named Hamburger University. Such responses to market needs are not new to American education, however. They have always been at its core. At the turn of the last century, technological advances required workers with a higher level of cognitive skills than was required for the dominant rural economy of previous decades. For instance, the ability to read manuals, to interpret blueprints, or to understand mathematical formulas. Youth were drawn from rural areas, where opportunities were limited, into more productive occupations in business and an advancing manufacturing sector. Our educational system responded. In the 1920s and 1930s, high school enrollment in this country expanded rapidly. It became the job of these institutions to prepare students for work life. In the context of the demands of the economy at that time, a high school diploma represented the training needed to be successful in most aspects of American enterprise. The economic returns in the job market from having a high school diploma rose, and as a result, high school enrollment rates climbed. By the time the United States entered World War II, the median level of education for a 17-year-old was a high school diploma, an accomplishment that set the United States apart from other countries. New demands created by economic progress also importantly influenced the evolution of our system of higher education. Although many states had established land-grant schools earlier, their support strengthened in the late 19th century as states whose economies specialized in agriculture and mining sought to take advantage of new scientific methods of production. Beginning in 1862, the federal government granted land, later funding, to the states for the creation of educational institutions to teach engineering, agriculture, and military tactics. Cornell, Texas A&M, the University of California at Berkeley, and Penn State are among more than 100 institutions founded under the land-grant program. Early in the 20th century, the content of education at an American college had evolved from a classically based curriculum to one combining the sciences, empirical studies, and modern liberal arts. Universities responded to the need for the application of science, particularly chemistry and physics, to the manufacture of steel, rubber, chemicals, drugs, petroleum, and other goods requiring the newer production technologies. America's reputation as a world leader in higher education is grounded in the ability of these versatile institutions, taken together, to serve the practical needs of an economy and, more important, to unleash the creative thinking that moves it forward. It is the recognition of these values that has attracted such a large segment of the world's student population to our institutions of higher learning. But while our universities, and especially our community colleges, have responded impressively, in recent decades, our elementary and secondary schools have not. In the foregoing, I have voiced concern about the state of our elementary and secondary education while lauding the world-class university system we have built over the generations. It should be clear, however, that unless the former can be brought up to world-class, the latter will either have to depend on foreign students or sink into mediocrity. The average age of our scientists and engineers is increasing, according to the National Science Foundation, and large numbers will retire in a very few years, lowering the supply of skilled workers relative to the growing requirements of an ever more complex capital stock. If we cannot replace these skilled workers, the pressure for a rising skilled-unskilled wage differential will grow, since no comparable shortage of lesser-skilled workers appears on the horizon. One of the skills too many high school graduates lack is proficiency in math. It is that skill, more than any other, that is required to achieve skilled job status. I do not pretend to be conversant with the details of U.S. education in the 21st century. Yet people whose scholarship I respect, and who are in a position to know, complain that the math teachers of my childhood have been replaced with teachers with degrees in education, but much too often with no math or science degree or competence in the subject matter. In 2000, for example, nearly two-fifths of public secondary school math teachers did not have a major or minor in math, math education, or a related field. Lou Gerstner, former chairman of IBM and founder of the Teaching Commission, noted in an essay for the Christian Science Monitor, December 13, 2004, "The heart of the problem is the arcane way we recruit and prepare teachers, along with the lockstep single salary schedule for all teachers, irrespective of their subject specialty, no matter how desperately society may need a certain skill set, and no matter how well a teacher performs in the classroom. That's senseless, yet it's still the norm in the teaching profession." Different pay scales for high school teachers in different disciplines may go against the ethos of teaching. Perhaps money should not be an incentive, but it is. There are doubtless math teachers in our high schools who are sufficiently dedicated to forego the much higher incomes they could earn in other jobs. But they must be few, for as Gerstner also points out, according to a 2000 study of the largest urban school districts, nearly 95% reported an immediate demand for math teachers, a quantity problem on top of the quality problem we clearly already have. It is becoming increasingly clear that a flat pay scale, when demand is far from flat, is a form of price fixing that undermines the ability to attract qualified math teachers. Since the financial opportunities for experts in math or science outside of teaching are vast, and for English literature teachers outside of teaching limited, math teachers are likely to be a cut below the average teaching professional at the same pay grade. Teaching math is likely being left to those who are unable to claim the more lucrative jobs. That is far less true of English literature or history teachers. Moreover, retirees or well-educated parents of students who volunteer to teach part-time courses, such as math, in which they have some proficiency, are turned down because they lack a degree in education. To the extent that such practices are widespread, they are bureaucratic impediments to the functioning of market forces in education. Fortunately, proposals to remedy this dysfunctional state of affairs are gaining traction. For example, James Simons, a distinguished mathematician who applied his skills to build one of Wall Street's most successful hedge funds, in 2004 turned his efforts toward enhancing the teaching of high school math. His Math for America has developed a high-stipend fellowship program to recruit and train high school math teachers. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York in 2006 embraced and offered legislation to advance this initiative. Enhancing elementary and secondary school sensitivity to market forces should help restore the balance between the demand for and supply of skilled workers in the United States. I do not know whether vouchers, which bring an element of competition to public schools, are the final answer. But I suspect that Rose and Milton Friedman, devoting the end of their distinguished careers to advancing the policy, were on the right track. I do not recall either ever being off track. Another step toward enhancing competition is an interesting paper written for the Hamilton Project, a Robert Rubin creation, at the Brookings Institution. The authors note that certification of teachers, which generally requires a degree in education, has little to do with whether a teacher is effective. They recommend opening up teaching to others who are qualified, including those who have a four-year undergraduate degree, but not the formal requirements for certification. They estimate that removing the barrier of certification would encourage recent college graduates and older professionals to try a teaching career. In addition, they recommend tracking teacher and student performance and making the achievement of tenure more difficult. They simulated these recommendations through a model based on the performance of 150,000 Los Angeles students from 2000 to 2003. The authors conclude that if the school system screened out the least qualified quarter of teachers, student test scores would be raised by as much as 14 percentile points by graduation. These are very large changes, and even if only fractionally achievable, such improvement in academic performance could go a long way to remedying the international inferiority of young American students. A recognition of how poor our mathematics education had become, and perhaps some reason for hope, was the report in September 2006 by the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, reversing its ill-chosen advisory of 1989. The earlier report recommended a curriculum that dropped emphasis on basic math skills, multiplication, division, square roots, and so on, and pressed students to seek more free-flowing solutions and to study a range of special math topics. I always wondered how you can learn math unless you have a thorough grounding in the basics and concentrate on a very few subjects at a time. Asking children to use their imagination before they know what they are imagining about seemed vacuous to me. It was. Another education imperative goes beyond fostering market forces in the schools. I recognize that left to their own devices, market incentives will not reach the education of those children left behind, to borrow a term from current U.S. education legislation. The cost of educational egalitarianism is doubtless high and may be difficult to justify in terms of economic efficiency and short-term productivity. Some students can achieve a given level of education far more easily, and therefore at far less cost, than others. Yet there is danger to a democratic society in leaving some children out of sync with its institutions. Such neglect contributes to exaggerated income concentration and could conceivably be far more costly to the sustaining of capitalism and globalization in the long run. The value judgments involved in making such choices reach beyond the imperatives of the marketplace. Unless our resident population, with the assistance of our schools, can supply the level of skills we need, which to date they have not, as our skilled baby boomers retire, we will require a significant increase in the number of skilled workers migrating to the United States. As Bill Gates, the chairman of Microsoft, succinctly testified before Congress in March 2007, America will find it infinitely more difficult to maintain its technological leadership if it shuts out the very people who are most able to help us compete. He added that, "We are driving away the world's best and brightest precisely when we need them most." Much of our skill shortage can be resolved with education reform, but at best, that will take years. The world is moving too fast for political and bureaucratic dawdling. We need to address quickly a double U.S. disability, the increasing income concentration and the increasing cost of staffing our highly complex capital stock. Both could be cured by opening up the United States to the world's very large and growing pool of skilled workers. Our skilled jobs are the highest paid in the world. Accordingly, were we to allow open migration of skilled workers to this country, there would soon be a lower wage premium of skilled over lesser skilled and an end to our shortages of skilled workers. The rise in the income spread between skilled and less skilled workers worldwide suggests that the shortage of skills is a global problem. Because international migration is so inhibited, the price for skills does not converge globally. It is clearly more of a problem in the United States than elsewhere. Hence, opening skilled immigration into the United States would put upward pressure on wages of non-U.S. skilled workers and increase income concentration by a modest amount. It would also lower the U.S. skilled wage level. The shortages occur because we are inhibiting world competitive labor markets from functioning. Administrative exclusionary rules have been substituted for the pricing mechanism. In the process, we have created in this country a privileged, native-born elite of skilled workers whose incomes are being supported at non-competitively high levels by immigration quotas on skilled professionals. Eliminating such restrictions would, at the stroke of a pen, reduce much income inequality and address the problem of a potentially non-competitive capital stock. The politics of immigration policy, of course, is influenced by far more than economics. immigration policy confronts the considerably more difficult issue of the desire of the population to maintain the cultural roots that tie the society together and foster voluntary exchange to mutual advantage. The United States has always been able eventually to absorb waves of immigration and maintain the individual rights and freedoms bestowed by our founding fathers. But the transitions were always more difficult than hindsight makes them appear. If we are to continue to engage the world and improve our standard of living, we will have to either markedly improve our elementary and secondary education or lower our barriers to skilled immigrants. In fact, implementing both measures would confer important economic benefits. Public policy is a series of choices. We can build exclusionary walls around the United States to keep out the goods, services, and people that compete with domestic producers and workers. The result would be a loss of competitive spark, leading to a stagnant and weakened economy. Our standard of living would fall, and societal discontent would fester and rise, as the once vaunted superpower fell from its position of world leadership. Alternatively, we can engage the increasingly competitive high-tech world, address our domestic school system's failure to supply a level of newly skilled workers sufficient to quell our disturbing increase in income inequality, and further open our borders to the world's growing skilled worker pool. No alternative offers a rising American standard of living without the challenge and stress of borders open to goods and people. Choice is what public policy is all about, and with choice come both benefits and costs. To achieve the benefits, we need to accept the costs. Chapter 22. The world retires, but can it afford to? Almost all of the developed world is at the edge of a demographic abyss for which there is no precedent. A huge cohort of workers, the baby boom generation, is about to move from productive work to retirement. There are too few younger workers to replace them, and the shortfall among skilled workers is even worse. The leading edge of change is particularly evident in Germany, where, despite high unemployment, severe shortages of skilled workers are mounting. A German job recruitment executive told the Financial Times, November 28, 2006, "The battle for workers has already begun, and given the demographic trends in Germany and in parts of southern and eastern Europe, it is about to get a lot worse." This tectonic shift is truly a 21st century problem. Retirement is a relatively new phenomenon in human history. Average life expectancy a century ago for much of the developed world was only 46 years. Relatively few people survived long enough to experience retirement. The ratio of the dependent elderly to the working age population has been rising in the industrialized world for at least 150 years. The pace of increase slowed markedly with the birth of the baby boom generation after World War II. But dependency of the elderly will almost certainly rise more rapidly as that generation reaches retirement age. The acceleration will be particularly dramatic in Japan and Europe. In Japan, the population share of those at least 65 years of age climbed from 13% to 21% in the past decade, and United Nations demographers expect it to reach 31% by 2030. The Japanese working age population is already declining and is projected to fall from 84 million in 2007 to 69 million by 2030. Europe's working age population is also anticipated to recede, though less than Japan's. The changes projected for the United States are not as severe, but nonetheless present daunting challenges. Over the next quarter century, the annual growth rate of the working age population in the United States is anticipated to slow from 1% today to about 0.3% by 2030. At the same time, the percentage of the population that is over 65 will rise markedly. Though the overall population is expected to continue to age, much of the aging of the labor force has already occurred with the aging of the baby boom generation. Once the baby boomers begin to retire, the mean age of the U.S. labor force is expected to stabilize. These anticipated changes in the age structure of our population and workforce result largely from the decline in fertility that followed the post-war birth surge. After peaking in 1957 at 3.7 births over a woman's lifetime, the fertility rate in the United States fell to 1.8 by the mid-1970s. Since 1990, it has stabilized at slightly less than 2.1, the so-called replacement rate, or the level required to hold the population constant in the absence of immigration or changes in longevity. The fertility rate used here is the total fertility rate. It is measured as the average number of children who would be born to a woman in her lifetime if she were to experience the birth rates by age observed in any given year. The decrease in the number of children per family since the baby boom has inevitably led to a projected increase in the ratio of elderly to those of working age. Continued immigration, however, will mitigate the impact of a falling birth rate, and population growth will be sustained as well by increases in life expectancy. In 1950, an American man 65 years of age could expect, on average, to live until age 78, whereas now he can expect to live to 82. And if current trends continue, by 2030 he can expect to live to 83. Women's life expectancy is rising similarly, from 80 in 1950 to roughly 84 today, and 85 by 2030, according to the Social Security Board of Trustees in 2007. The trustees for Social Security and Medicare include the Secretaries of the Treasury and Labor, and two public trustees appointed by the President. Americans not only are living longer, but we are also generally living healthier. Rates of disability for the elderly have been declining, reflecting improvements in all phases of medicine, as well as the changing character of work. It is becoming less physically strenuous and more demanding intellectually, continuing a century-long trend toward a more conceptual and less physical economic output. In 1900, for example, only one out of every 10 workers was in a professional, technical, or managerial occupation. By 1970, that proportion had doubled, and today, those types of jobs account for about one-third of our workforce. An inevitable consequence, then, of the aging of America will be that more of our elderly population will have both the ability and the incentive to work later and later into old age. Workers in their 60s have accumulated many years of valuable experience, so extending labor force participation by just a few years could have a sizable impact on economic output. But there is no getting around it. Almost all of the baby boom generation will have retired by 2030, and their retirement will be unmatched in length by any previous generation. Will those golden years be truly golden? How will the more slowly growing U.S. workforce that will follow the baby boomers produce goods and services for themselves and their families, as well as for a retired population whose size is without precedent? The hard facts of demography will have a profoundly wrenching effect on the balance of world economic power. Aging is not an immediate issue for less developed nations, with the exception of China, which has suppressed its birth rate through central planning, the government's one-child policy. The United Nations projects that the share of world population residing in what are today's developed nations will fall to 15.2% by 2030 from 18.3% today. How developed nations cope in the face of such a shift may go a long way toward either assuaging or intensifying changes in the world's economic balance of power. Critical to the outcome is whether developed nations, confronted with loss of power and prestige, become inward-looking and erect barriers to trade with a burgeoning developing world. How governments finesse the transfer of real resources from the shrinking shares of their populations who make up their productive workforce to a growing retirement population is likely to be a defining question of the next quarter century. For democratic societies, the politics will be particularly daunting, as an increasing share of the electorate will be benefit recipient retirees. The economics of retirement is straightforward. Enough resources must be set aside over a lifetime of work to fund consumption during retirement. The bottom line in the success of all retirement systems is the availability of real resources at retirement. The financial arrangements associated with retirement facilitate the diversion of resources that make possible the consumption of goods and services after retirement, but they do not produce those goods and services. In the United States, Congress may pass, and the President may sign, legislation that, for example, provides an entitlement upon retirement to a specified level of health care. But who assures that the hospitals, pharmaceutical companies, physicians, nurses, and medical infrastructure generally will be in place to convert a paper promise into valuable future medical services? A simple test for any retirement system is whether it can assure the availability of promised real resources to retirees without overly burdening the working-age population. By that measure, America may be on a collision course with reality. The oldest baby boomers become eligible for Social Security in 2008. By 2030, according to UN projections, people 65 years of age and older will account for more than 23% of the adult population, compared with 16% today. This huge population shift will expose all our financial retirement systems to severe stress and will require adjustments for which there are no historical precedents. The fact that a greater share of the dependents will be elderly rather than children will put an additional burden on society's resources, as the elderly per capita consume a relatively large share of resources, while children consume relatively little. Despite the growing feasibility of work at older ages, Americans have been retiring younger and younger. In 1940, for example, the median age of retirement for men was 69. By 2005, the median age was about 62. After receding for years, labor force participation among older Americans has edged somewhat higher recently, owing to rising pressures on retirement incomes and a growing scarcity of experienced labor. As I noted earlier, it will no doubt continue to rise. Nonetheless, the most effective way to boost future standards of living and thereby accommodate the aspirations of both workers and retirees is to increase the nation's savings and the productiveness of its uses. Additionally, we could borrow from abroad, which should build up the U.S. physical capital stock. In doing so, however, we would also build up a liability to foreigners that we would have to finance in the future. That is, less of our future GDP would be available for consumption by U.S. residents. We need significant additional saving in the decades ahead if we are to finance the construction of capital facilities, for example, cutting-edge high-tech plant and equipment, that will produce the additional real resources to ensure that the promised retirement benefits for the baby boomers will be redeemable in real terms. And we need to do this without having to severely raise burdens on tomorrow's workers. However, by almost any measure, the additional saving required to take care of the surge in retirees is sufficiently large to raise serious questions about whether the federal government will be able to meet the retirement commitments already made. The trustees of the Social Security system calculate that it would take either an immediate increase in the payroll tax from its current 12.4% to 14.4%, an immediate across-the-board cut in benefits of 13%, or some combination of the two to close the funding shortfall over the next 75 years. Postponing or phasing in the adjustments would require higher taxes or lower benefits later. And because of the large deficits projected beyond the 75-year horizon, 75-year solvency, the somewhat arbitrary standard for social insurance, will require further adjustments later. While the projected shortfall is problematic, it doesn't by itself create insurmountable fiscal or economic difficulties. Most important, projections of Social Security benefits are relatively reliable. That is because the demographics of the retiree population are among economists' most accurate forecasts, and because Social Security is a defined benefit program, so payments per beneficiary are reasonably predictable in advance. Medicare, by contrast, poses a much bigger problem. The trustees forecast a 75-year funding shortfall for Part A of Medicare, the hospital insurance fund, which could be closed with an immediate increase of 3.5 percentage points on top of the current 2.9% levy on taxable payroll to a total of 6.4%, or an immediate halving of benefits or some combination of the two. But that's not the end of it. The costs of Part B of Medicare, which pays doctor bills and other outpatient expenses, and the new Part D, which pays for access to prescription drug coverage, are both projected to rise rapidly. But they are mandated to be met by general tax revenues rather than by payroll taxes. Although not as visible as hospital insurance taxes, the claims on general tax revenues of future Parts B and D benefits are of the same order of magnitude as those of Part A. The public trustees, coming at future Medicare costs from a different perspective, commented in 2006 that if the trustees' projections prove a reliable guide to the next few decades, absent an increase in earmarked sources of revenue for the program, in just 15 years, payment of currently scheduled Medicare benefits would require general fund transfers equal to 25% of federal income tax revenues, more than triple their 2005 fiscal burden, and less than 10 years later, the general fund transfer would equal nearly 40% of federal income tax revenues. But even such numbers do not necessarily capture the full dimension of the problem because projections of Medicare benefits are highly uncertain. Health spending has been growing faster than the economy for many years, a growth fueled in large part by advances in technology. We know very little about how rapidly medical technology will evolve or how those innovations will translate into future spending. Technological innovations can greatly improve the quality of medical care and can, in some instances, reduce the costs of treatment and surely the costs of hospital administration. But because technology expands the set of treatment possibilities, it also has the potential to add to overall spending, in some cases by a great deal. As encrypted private health records become sufficiently widespread, researchers will for the first time be able effectively to evaluate treatments and outcomes for a broad spectrum of diseases. I assume a standard for national best practices will emerge as a result. Eventually, public ratings of hospitals and physicians will come too. Market competition can be expected to follow. Yet none of this is likely to happen very fast. Medical practice hinges on what traditionally has been a very private relationship between physician and patient, and both are reluctant to risk a breach in privacy. Medical practice in the United States has evolved quite differently from region to region. I presume that nationwide best practices, by eliminating the worst treatments and practitioners, will enhance average outcomes, but it is by no means clear whether a nationwide awareness of and demand for best practices would increase or decrease medical expenditures. We need to keep in mind that the uncertainties, especially our inability to identify that upper bound of future demands for medical care, warrant significant restraint in policymaking. The critical reason to proceed cautiously is that new programs quickly develop constituencies willing to resist any curtailment fiercely. As a consequence, our ability to rein in deficit-expanding initiatives, should they later prove to have been excessive or misguided, is quite limited. Policymakers should err on the side of prudence when considering new budget entitlement initiatives. Programs can always be expanded in the future should the resources for them become available, but they cannot easily be cut back if resources later fall short of commitments. This is why I believe that moving forward with an unfunded prescription drug program in 2003, before the problems of the severely underfunded and out-of-balance Medicare program as a whole were addressed, was a mistake, perhaps a very large one. Fortunately, and unusually, the cost of Medicare Part D, the prescription drug program, has to date come in below initial projections. Possibly the program has fostered the competition it was structured to create. However, it is still an unfunded and large, growing expense. Having participated in a number of studies that simulated future Medicare costs and benefits, I am struck by the breadth of the range of possible outcomes for, say, the year 2030. As I noted, the range of possibilities for Social Security is quite narrow. Demographers, of course, have the same good handle on the number of future Medicare beneficiaries. But average cost per beneficiary under current law depends not only on future technologies, but also on patient choices and a whole series of other variables. The forecasting complexity is such that the trustees have had to fall back on a simple algorithm. A projected rate of growth of benefits per Medicare recipient relative to the projected rate of growth of per capita GDP. Growth in real Medicare outlays per beneficiary has averaged approximately 4% a year over the past decade, about 2 percentage points higher than growth in real per capita GDP. The public trustees go on to note, "It seems reasonable to assume per capita health care and Medicare expenditure growth will gradually slow to the rate of growth of GDP because there is presumably some upper limit to what share of their growing incomes Americans will want to devote to health care." That may, in fact, turn out to be true. But, as anyone who knows the ways of Washington must realize, such an assumption also involves quite a spectacular leap. It implies a degree of restraint that is not written into current law. It assumes a fiscal victory in a political battle that has yet to be fought. As the public trustees themselves observe, no such slowdown has materialized over the past half century. Thus, the projected tax burden of mounting Medicare spending presumably would be even larger if based strictly on current entitlement law and current trends in healthcare spending. There is a great deal of work to be done to set Medicare right. It should be apparent that to cover future Social Security and Medicare funding shortfalls wholly by raising taxes is economically infeasible. Doing so would imply unprecedented peacetime tax rates. At some point, tax rate increases become self-defeating. By absorbing purchasing power and reducing work and investment incentives, they reduce the economy's growth rate. Hence, the growth of the tax base slows and the projected additional tax revenues fail to materialize fully. We are left with a most daunting reality. Resolving the funding shortfall for federal social insurance is going to require benefit cuts. Government has a moral obligation to make these cuts sooner rather than later, to afford future retirees as much time as possible to adjust their plans for work, saving, and retirement spending. Failure to give Americans adequate warning that the retirement income upon which they have planned will be reduced could threaten major disruptions in people's lives. Once the level of benefits that Social Security and Medicare can reasonably promise is determined, how can public policy ensure that the real resources will become available to fulfill those promises? Focusing on financial solvency within the Social Security and Medicare systems without regard to the broader macroeconomic picture does not ensure that the resources will be there. Without additional net saving, the real resources required to produce future benefits will not be produced. Thus, in addressing the imbalances of Social Security and Medicare, we need to ensure that measures taken now to finance future benefit commitments represent real additions to national saving and the productive assets they fund. We need, in effect, to make real the phantom lockboxes of a few years back, which were supposed to contain the cash to fund future Social Security benefits. The lockboxes were so real to many Americans that former Speaker of the House Tom Foley tells the story of his mother's berating him for trying to disabuse her of that belief. "Mr. Foley," she said, "I hope you will not be offended at how surprised and shocked I am to find that the majority leader of the House of Representatives knows nothing about Social Security." At that time, the lockbox proposals would have required not only putting the Social Insurance Trust funds, currently in surplus, off budget for accounting purposes, but also having Congress mandate that the remainder of the budget be balanced. For a brief period in the flush fiscal surplus years at the turn of the millennium, a bipartisan commitment emerged to do just that. But regrettably, the commitment collapsed when it became apparent that, in light of a less favorable economic environment, maintaining balance in the budget, excluding Social Security and Medicare, would require significantly lower spending or higher taxes. Failure to address the imbalances between promises to future retirees and the economy's ability to meet those promises could have severe consequences for individual retirees and the economy as a whole. In the end, I expect the Medicare funding imbalance to be resolved by rescinding the benefits of the more affluent. How much a cut in benefits would reduce outlays on medical services is uncertain. Several years ago, I requested the Federal Reserve Board staff to simulate the level of medical service outlays through 2004, assuming that Medicare and Medicaid entitlements had never been enacted. The staff concluded that outlays would have been only modestly lower. Market efficiencies, however, could have been quite considerable. The frenzy of politics and the so far intractable continued increase in income inequality, in my judgment, leaves no other credible political alternative. Restored balance could occur through the development of private accounts, which I support, or through legislation requiring Medicare to be means-tested, as is Medicaid. Rationing is the only other realistic possibility, and that has little support in the United States. Most future Medicare benefits will surely be concentrated in the middle and lower income groups. Medical service for upper income recipients will have to be funded by unsubsidized private medical insurance or out of pocket, probably in the form of co-payments approaching 100%. Many will recoil from the concept of Medicare as welfare, as means-tested programs tend to be seen, but the arithmetic of 21st century demographics in a highly competitive global economy necessitates it. While I favor a liberal immigration policy, I do not do so as a means of increasing the working population in order to raise social insurance taxes to help address the Social Security Medicare funding shortfall. Nor, for reasons I will discuss later, can we count on a fortuitous increase in productivity. The long-term ceiling for increases in output per hour in the United States appears to be 3% a year. with 2% being the most likely outcome. In brief, we likely won't have enough people working, nor will we likely have a sufficient increase in the amount each worker on average can produce to cover the enormous shortfall from entitlements under current law. It may not even be close. With so many unknowns, I fear that given our demographics and the limited upside potential of productivity growth, we may already have committed to a higher level of real medical resources for baby boomer retirees than our government can realistically deliver. As previously noted, Congress can enact an entitlement, but that in itself does not produce the economic resources required to provide the hospitals, physicians, nurses, and pharmaceutical companies that will be essential in 2030 to meet the letter of current law. The size in 2030 of the transfer of real resources from worker producers to retirees may be too large for the former to accept. The claims on the nation's output, because of an unfunded expansion of entitlements, may far exceed the output produced by a workforce only marginally larger than exists today. In short, the promises may have to be broken, or perhaps better said, they may have to be clarified. The significant uncertainties about the availability of future real resources are reflected in uncertainties in retiree income replacement rates. Given today's expected yawning gap between retirement needs and even current large entitlement promises, private pension and insurance benefits are going to have to play an increasingly greater role. At the end of 2006, private pension funds in the United States had $5.6 trillion in assets, $2.3 trillion in the traditional defined benefit programs, and $3.3 trillion in defined contribution plans, largely 401ks. In addition, $3.7 trillion was held in individual retirement accounts, IRAs. Private pension and profit-sharing funds paid out $344 billion in benefits in 2005. Group health insurance paid out an additional $581 billion, but predominantly to those under 65 years of age. By comparison, Social Security and Medicare paid out $845 billion. The former is bound to catch up with the latter as American workers and their employers take the steps necessary to meet workers' retirement income goals. But that is years out. Now, defined benefit pensions are in trouble. Those plans can flourish in periods of relatively short life expectancy after retirement and a rapidly growing population. The unprecedented size of the baby boom generation and its projected longevity have dramatically reduced the advantages of defined benefit plans. Significant pension obligations have already been defaulted to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. The legal obligation to pay benefits in a defined benefit plan, of course, rests with the employer. The pension fund is there for backup, but since certain levels of funding are mandated by law, corporations view their defined benefit pension fund as a profit opportunity. The greater the pension fund's investment revenues, the less additional cash the sponsoring corporation is required to put into the fund. And the less the cash infusion, the less the current cost of labor, and the greater the profits. Consequently, the corporation is driven to find ways to reduce payments into the fund. Since corporations know with reasonable certainty who will retire, when, and with what promised benefits for years into the future, isn't the cost a simple calculation? Not quite. The expected cost to a company of a defined benefit plan depends in part on the status of pension benefits in the event of bankruptcy. For example, where pension benefits by contract have first claim on corporate resources in the event of default, the calculation of benefit cost is unambiguous. In such circumstances, the corporation might choose to set up a pension fund of riskless U.S. Treasury securities whose maturities match the timing of the benefit payments. Benefits would be generated by the principal and accumulated interest of a U.S. Treasury security maturing in the year the benefits are required to be paid. In practice, corporations try every which way to get around so simple a program because it is the most costly. Corporate equity, real estate, junk bonds, and even AAA corporate bonds yield a greater return than treasuries. But all have risk of default, and in the event of default, the sponsoring corporation would have to use its other assets or not pay its pension obligations. The debate as to what rate of return a pension fund should seek, and therefore how much risk it can accept, depends, in the end, on how certain the corporation wants to be of paying its promised benefits. the greater the risk to pension assets, the greater the profit margin of the investment. Financial theory would seem to make the achievement of higher returns illusory. If the markets are pricing risk correctly, the pension fund's rate of return should be indifferent to the degree of risk in the portfolio, since higher rates of return compensate for the losses of risky securities, which often become worthless. But what is true in theory doesn't always work out in practice, or, more appropriately, you need a new theory. Pension managers will tell you that the actual realized rates of return over the long run for equities are above the so-called average risk-adjusted rates of return for the U.S. economy as a whole. Rates of return since the 19th century confirm that diversified holdings of stocks over decades-long holding periods have invariably yielded above-average real rates of return. As I've noted, this is probably the result of an innate human aversion to risk. Anyone willing to stomach the stress of irrevocable long-term commitments to stocks gathers a higher return. Thus, defined benefit pension funds that are able to hold investments untouched for decades often keep a majority of their assets in equities. To lower the cost to the corporation, defined benefit pension funds take risks, including the risks of short-run fluctuations in the prices of their equities and other assets. And those risks, largely through heavy investments in equities, have consequences, both good and bad. When stock prices are rising, capital gains, in effect, pay for a significant part of the corporation's contribution to its defined benefit program. Since cash contributions are lower, reported profits, accordingly, are higher. Conversely, when stock prices fall, as they did from 2000 to 2002, a large number of pension plans became underfunded. There is no getting around the fact that portfolio risks jeopardize retiree benefits. Many corporations with very large unfunded pension liabilities in recent years, such as steel companies and airlines, have chosen bankruptcy and turned their pension obligations over to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, that is, largely to the American taxpayer. Fortunately, the Pension Protection Act of 2006 significantly reduced taxpayers' exposure to private pension shortfalls, but it has by no means eliminated them. All defined benefit pension funds yield a rate of return that is variable and, especially in the short run, unpredictable. But the corporation has a legal obligation to pay a defined fixed benefit. This requires a third party, almost always the sponsoring corporation itself, to swap the variable revenues of a defined benefit plan portfolio into the fixed payments required by contract. In recent years, the cost of that swap has grown. Partly as a consequence, many corporations have adopted defined contribution pension plans. The share of total pension fund assets held under defined benefit plans declined from 65% in 1985 to 41% at the end of 2006. The trend shows no signs of abating. Corporate sponsors of defined contribution plans will likely become more focused on the forms of investments their employees can make, and even on some rules on how quickly, following retirement, such funds can be dispersed. I anticipate that defined contribution plans will also gradually displace part of Social Security as the latter's financing capabilities fall with the ratio of workers to retired beneficiaries over time. As the magnitude and implications of the retirement burden gradually become evident to potential retirees, an increasingly healthy elderly population is very likely to find it necessary to postpone retirement. But of greater relevance, the transfer of real resources from workers to retirees will of necessity be increasingly financed by 401k plans, private insurance, and many as yet unidentified new financing vehicles. In the United States, most higher-income baby boomers have wealth and sources of income that should prove more than adequate to fund retirement. Middle and lower-income boomers will find financing more problematic. Endeavoring to maintain today's pay-as-you-go government-backed social insurance programs, whose arithmetic requires high ratios of workers to retirees, is going to prove increasingly burdensome and unacceptable. By default, the only viable option almost surely will turn out to be some form of private financing. I've posed a question in the title of this chapter, "The World Retires, But Can It Afford to?" The answer is, it will find ways. The world has no choice. Demography is destiny. Chapter 23. Corporate Governance. Do I have to accept the Enron Prize? I asked in November 2001 of my old friend and mentor Jim Baker. It's part of the Baker Institute program at which you're speaking, he replied. I had not been aware that an award was being given at the dinner. Enron's stock was collapsing, and within 3 weeks the company would be in default. That November, prize hardly seemed the appropriate term. But I owed Jim Baker a great deal, so, provided there was no official presentation or money involved, I agreed to accept the award. Enron had puzzled me ever since I'd heard Jeffrey Skilling, its soon-to-be CEO, give a presentation at a meeting of the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas in December 2000. He went through a very sophisticated explanation of how this high-flying 21st-century company operated. It was impressive, but I came away with nagging questions. What did Enron produce? How did it make money? I understood the company's clever derivative and hedging strategies, but what profit stream was being hedged? Enron's demise, according to Skilling after the fact, was precipitated by a collapse in confidence in the firm, which destroyed its ability to borrow. That didn't seem quite right to me. I presumed that if a major steel company experienced a collapse of confidence, its steel furnaces would still have some value. Impalpable Enron, however, went up in a puff of smoke, leaving little trace except the anger of its employees and shareholders. I had never seen a major U.S. company fall from icon to pariah to virtual non-existence so quickly. The Enron debacle and the scandal surrounding the collapse of WorldCom the following summer were particularly worrisome to me. In the quarter century prior to my joining the Fed, I'd served on 15 publicly listed corporate boards, not all concurrently, of course, and had become quite familiar with the levers of power in those companies. I had also become increasingly aware of the disconnect between how American corporations were governed and how that governance was perceived by the public and our political leaders. The public, already suspicious of business ethics, if it doesn't consider the term an outright oxymoron, was not, I feared, prepared to accept revelations undercutting widely held beliefs about the way corporations were governed. Much of the corporate governance practices of myth have long since been displaced by the imperatives of a modern economy. Throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries, shareholders, in many instances controlling shareholders, actively participated in governing U.S. corporations. They appointed the board of directors, who in turn hired the CEO and other officers, and in general controlled the strategies of the company. Corporate governance had the trappings of democratic representative government. But ownership diffused over the following generations, and the managerial and entrepreneurial skills of company founders were not always inherited by their offspring. As financial institutions evolved over the 20th century, shareholding became a matter of investment, not active ownership. If a shareholder did not like the way a company was managed, he sold his stock. Only rarely was the management of reasonably profitable corporations challenged. Imperceptibly, corporate governance moved from shareholder control to control by the CEO. Aside from the outspoken concern of a few academics, the change occurred quietly and largely by default. As shareholders became ever less engaged, the CEOs began to recommend slates of directors to shareholders, who were soon rubber-stamping them. Periodically, this paradigm went astray when a company or its management got into trouble, but such episodes were relatively rare. Democratic corporate governance had morphed into a type of authoritarianism. The CEO would enter the boardroom, explain the corporation's new capital investment program, and turn to his chief financial officer for corroboration. Then, without meaningful deliberation, the board would approve the project. The CEO of a profitable corporation today is given vast powers by the board of directors he essentially appoints. Over the decades, government agencies and various interest groups have pressed large institutional investors, especially pension funds, to vote their shares in a manner that would resurrect the corporate democracy of earlier decades. But these institutions argue that their responsibility to their pensioners is to invest profitably, and that their expertise is in judging financial market value, not in the alien practice of corporate management. Some public pension funds have become more engaged, but their activities are marginal. Market forces are driving private equity funds to become increasingly committed to overseeing the management of the properties they own. But while the trend is rapidly growing, these funds remain a very small segment of corporate governance. Market forces are also driving mergers and acquisitions, processes in which managements rarely survive unscathed. So-called hostile takeovers may be seen as pure corporate democracy once we recognize that the only hostility is between a set of new shareholders and the company's entrenched management. The existing shareholders are voluntarily selling their stock, and in most instances are eager to do so and presumably delighted with the price they get. It should not come as a surprise that, as with authoritarianism everywhere, the lack of adequate accountability in corporate management has spawned abuse. It was pretty clear during my quarter century on corporate boards that petty abuse was widespread, and on occasion the abuse rose above the petty. Accordingly, I am not surprised that the outsized CEO compensation packages of recent years have raised public concerns of unseemliness. Most nettling has been the dramatic rise in the ratio of CEO compensation relative to gains in average employee salary. Directors who determine executive salaries argue in response that key decisions by CEOs leverage vast amounts of market value. In global markets, the difference between a right move and an almost right move might represent hundreds of millions of dollars, whereas a generation ago, when the playing field was much smaller, the difference would have been in the tens of millions. Boards reflecting this view feel pressed by competition to seek the very best CEO, and are obviously willing to pay what it takes to acquire the stars. A CEO's compensation has, on average, been tied closely to the market value of his or her firm. The average market capitalization of an S&P 500 corporation rose from less than $2 billion in 1980 to $26 billion in 2006. The average market value of the 10 largest S&P 500 companies in 2006 was $260 billion. CEO compensation at such large U.S. corporations reportedly rose by 10% annually between 1993 and 2006, triple the 3.5%